I'm Gail Harris.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
Former New York City Mayor Rudolph Giuliani testified before the 9/11 Commission in New York today. He told a room crowded with survivors and victims' families that there were terrible mistakes made on September 11, 2001, but that they were unavoidable because of the unprecedented circumstances of the day.
We're all hurt. We're all damaged. We're all very, very angry. But we have to channel our anger toward doing all that we can to prevent and ameliorate any further attack, because by all predictions, further attacks are going to come. Our enemy is not each other, but the terrorists who attacked us.
Giuliani testified on the second day of hearings as the commission examines mistakes made by emergency response teams the day of the attacks. Also testifying today, New York Mayor Michael Bloomberg and Secretary of Homeland Security Tom Ridge. Associated Press reporter Warren Levinson is attending the proceedings. He joins us now from New York. And Warren, the commission released a report today that seems to include more damning revelations about the city's 9/11 emergency system. What can you tell us?
What they said was that the 911 system was simply not capable of handling a very large emergency. What happened on September 11th, as it turns out, was that for many people who were trapped in the towers of the World Trade Center, 911 was their only possible source of reliable information. And the 911 operators, who were just overwhelmed with phone calls, were not only not in a position to give them information such as don't go upstairs, you won't be able to get out that way, information get out of the building now, regardless of what they may be telling you on the public address system. Not only didn't they have time to tell people that, but they didn't actually have that information to give them.
Yeah. Giuliani also said today that a White House briefing paper on possible terrorist attacks on New York never reached City Hall. Now, he went on to say that it wouldn't have mattered, but how was that received?
It didn't get much reaction from the commission, which surprised me a little bit. It got a strong reaction from some of the families in the room. That, in fact, it seemed to me, was about the only new part of the new revelation in the Giuliani testimony. Most of it was a well-rehearsed story and a familiar story about how difficult things were on 9/11 and how he had to rush from place to place to set up a command post and to try to buck up the city and to help direct a rescue effort.
You said the family seemed to react angrily. We have some of that sound. Let's listen. And that went on for quite a while, as you know. Now, Mayor Giuliani said that the briefing paper not reaching City Hall didn't matter. Did he explain why?
He said, well, because nobody imagined what could have happened. What we were preparing for was a ground-based some kind of bombing. So if there had been, if they'd seen the briefing paper that said Osama bin Laden determined to attack in the United States, what they'd have done most likely would have been to find some way to raise their alert level and harden the ground targets against a truck bomb.
Now, even though, did the briefing paper mention the World Trade Towers or other tall buildings?
I don't recall if it specifically mentioned the World Trade Tower or other tall buildings, but of course, since the World Trade Center had been bombed in 1993, and since there had been a plot foiled to bomb New York City landmarks, it was certainly known that New York was a prime target of terrorists, so anything involving terror would have immediately set off, raised red flags in New York.
Warren, what else stood out for you from today's testimony in about a minute?
Well, the amazing thing that stood out was essentially the reaction of the family members that you played just a little bit of. Essentially, when Mayor Giuliani said at one point that many firefighters may have heard an evacuation order, but interpreted as meaning, well, I'll evacuate in due time as soon as I take care of finding other people to evacuate out of here. Some of the members of families who'd lost firefighters simply could not contain themselves any longer. That's what started the shouting in the room. They felt like, no, that's not what happened. The scandal here is the radios that did not give our loved ones the evacuation order, that if they had heard the evacuation order, they would have gotten out of there. And they didn't get out of there not because of a sense of duty, but because they didn't hear an order and because the radios weren't working, and it was scandalous that they weren't.
Mm-hmm. Warren, thank you.
You bet.
Warren Levinson is covering the 9/11 hearings for the Associated Press. The The Pentagon says another disk of photographs from Abu Ghraib prison has become available. With that disclosure and amid accusations of politicizing the scandal, the Senate Armed Services Committee is hearing today from the top generals in Iraq about the abuse of detainees. As he did in hearings last week, Republican Senator from South Carolina Lindsey Graham asked some of the toughest questions.
Explain how the abuse could have happened at this level, this long, with this much devastation to our country, and no one know about it before January and the photos given over by the specialist.
Well, I think there are failures in people doing their duty. There are failures in systems, and we should have known and we should have uncovered it and taken action before it got to the point that it got to.
And that response was from Central Command Chief General John Abizaid. Well, joining us on the line now from Washington is Tom Bowman, military affairs reporter for the Baltimore Sun. Hello, Tom.
Good to be with you.
You've been watching the hearing, as we have, and I know you were particularly interested in what the top commander on the ground in Iraq had to say, Lieutenant General Ricardo Sanchez. He brought along his legal advisor. He gave a long list of memos that he had issued on interrogations and the actions he took to prevent abuse. Was he convincing?
Well, it's interesting. General Sanchez essentially tossed this back into the prison and put it on the backs of the military police and the military intelligence officers. Last week, we heard the head of Army Intelligence assume that the interrogation rules of engagement, as they're called, two lists of techniques. There's one on the left side that's a little more minor, and there's one on the right-hand side of this slide that's a little more intense. And it was assumed that Sanchez or his command put this together, but now they're saying that a low-level officer, a captain, put it together.
Actually, Tom, we have a little of that exchange. This was between Senator Jack Reed, Democrat from Rhode Island, who asked General Sanchez about who approved that slide of interrogation techniques. Let's listen.
What level of command produced this slide?
Sir, my understanding is that that was produced at the company commander level.
How could the company commander evolve such a specific list? How could the company commander then turn around and said some of these things would require your permission without any interaction between your command? It seems to me just difficult to understand.
Sir, it's difficult for me to understand it. You'd have to ask the commander.
And this is the company commander that you relieved and gave him a letter of admonition?
No, sir.
So, Tom, what does that tell us about the chain of command and what was on that slide?
Well, again, there were some sort of minor interrogation techniques on the slide, direct questioning and so forth, incentive removal, sort of, removing, maybe pillows or blankets or something like that. On the right-hand side, we have something more severe, isolation for longer than 30 days, presence of military working dogs, stress positions for no longer than 45 minutes. The general did say that, and these required his approval. He said that in 25 instances, he approved isolation for longer than 30 days, but denied at the lower level of Colonel Pappas, who ran the prison, stress positions. They were denied on three occasions. And again, it's interesting that he is sort of tossing this back into the prison and saying that the military intelligence folks were the ones that were responsible and also essentially the MPs.
Mm.
But there's one interesting point that General Abizaid raised. It's the question of the Red Cross. They were complaining last year about some of the problems they saw there. And in particular, in October, they went through Abu Ghraib. Now, it's October, November, December that General Taguba investigated and found a number of serious problems there. So the Red Cross went in October and found naked Iraqis kept in dark cells, and they were so upset that they went to a military intelligence officer. They don't name him. But and the military intelligence officer said, well, this is our process. And we know that this report went to Sanchez's deputy, Major Walter Wojciechowski.
Thanks, Tom. Can I ask you just for a quick wrap? So this is all about the chain of command. It's continuing through today?
It is indeed, yeah.
All right.
The hearing will be held today. And I'm sure it will continue on.
Okay. Thanks so much, Tom.
Okay.
Tom Bowman is military affairs reporter for the Baltimore Sun. Well, U.S. Army Reserve Specialist Jeremy Sivitz broke down in tears today as he pled guilty in the first court-martial to come from the prison scandal. Sivitz, a 24-year-old from Pennsylvania, was sentenced to 1 year in prison, a reduction in rank, and a bad conduct discharge for, among other things, taking photographs of Iraqi prisoners. He's expected to testify against other soldiers involved in the scandal. Joining us on the line from Baghdad is Melinda Liu of Newsweek magazine. Melinda, Sivitz took that now famous photo of the Iraqi detainees in a human pyramid. What were the other charges against him?
Basically, he pleaded guilty to conspiracy to mistreat detainees, dereliction of duty, and mistreatment of detainees. Basically, he was in a position to, you know, protest against the abuse of detainees, which he saw other people doing, and he did not. He sort of he didn't even tell anyone about it afterwards. He just sort of went along with it. Mm-hmm. Although he, in the courtroom today, seemed very remorseful, and he was struggling to regain his composure when he talked about one detainee who was punched in the chest, and people feared he might have gone into cardiac arrest. Another who was also hit, and you know, some of the sexual humiliation that took place. It was a surprisingly emotional session, and longer than most court martials. And
what did he say? What did he say?
Well, he said he apologized to the Iraqi people. He went into extreme detail about what he saw, which included prisoners being stripped and told to masturbate and told to simulate positions of, simulating fellatio. And he was he seemed to be quite emotional when he was recounting all of these situations.
Melinda, three other soldiers were arraigned today. Can you tell us briefly what happened there?
Basically, those were much more ritualistic and legalistic legal proceedings. They were very fast. These were three people that Sivitz is expected to testify against in the coming courts martials in the future. Basically, these three people, defendants Grainer, Frederick, and Davis, not only deferred their plea, in other words, they weren't deciding on what their pleas would be, but they indicated each of them would have a civilian lawyer as well as a military lawyer. This all suggests that they're going to take it all the way to the end, that they're not going to do what Sivitz did in cop a plea.
Well, the LA Times is reporting that they are going to refuse to testify in order to, avoid self-incrimination.
It's certainly one of their tactics, and they could also get all tangled up in what kind of witnesses they're going to call. I mean, in theory, this sort of thing could go very high up in the chain of command, or get very deep into certain kinds of security issues. One of the interesting things about the court-martial...
Melinda, I'm sorry. Melinda, we're going to have to hold that for another day. We so appreciate it, though.
Okay.
Melinda Liu of Newsweek, she's speaking
You're
to us
welcome.
From Baghdad. Thank you, Melinda.
There's more coming up here and now.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Gail Harris.
It's Here and Now.
When political scientist Samuel Huntington first wrote about what he termed the clash of civilizations in the 1990s, that idea was hotly debated. Now, post-September 11th, and with thousands of American troops still in Iraq, many say he got it exactly right, that cultural differences are the major cause of global tension between the West and Islamic cultures. Samuel Huntington is back with a new book, which is again sparking a lively debate. His new work is titled, Who Are We? The Challenges to America's National Identity. Huntington is a professor at Harvard University, and he joins us for more on those challenges. Hello, Professor.
How do you do?
Very well, thanks. I want to start with the title of your book, in which you inquire as to who we are. So I wonder if you'd answer that for us. Who are we these days, and why do you think we should be concerned with the answer to that question?
Well, I think we should be concerned because historically we have defined our identity in four ways in terms of race, ethnicity, culture, and political principles, or what is often referred to as the American Creed. Happily, we have pretty much eliminated race and ethnicity from the way in which we defined our identity. And so now we define ourselves in terms of a culture, which I argue is basically the Anglo-Protestant culture of the founding settlers here in the 17th and 18th centuries, and in terms of political principles, which Jefferson most famously summarized in the Declaration of Independence. These are now, I believe, under challenge from a variety of sources.
Well, is it life or liberty or the pursuit of happiness that's in danger here?
Well, I think some of those principles are threatened. I'm more concerned with our culture, which I believe is the basis of our creed. And here we have had the decline in the salience of national identity during the latter part of the 20th century with the rise of multiculturalism and the extent to which a subnational group identity, racial, ethnic, gender, and others, took precedence over national identity. We have had, as a result of globalization, people increasingly having two or more national identities and viewing themselves as dual nationals and dual citizens.
You also write that people who voluntarily choose to leave the country of their birth are different from those who remain behind, and that historically America has gotten energetic, ambitious risk-takers who come here, but that now those qualities might be helpful, but they're not absolutely necessary. And I wonder how you think that changes the picture in terms of national identity and what these people have to contribute to America.
Well, I think in the past there was a real commitment to come here. Now, they may still come, but it is now fairly easy to come, and it is very easy also to maintain one's ties with one's ancestral country, and so you don't have the severing of the cords, which generally occurred in the previous waves of immigration.
So there was a time when people came here and they were ready to be Americans, and now they're not quite so committed to that.
Oh, that's, yes. There's ample evidence of that. People say, yes, we're both.
Well, and don't we need both? You point out that there are multinational corporations now and elites who hold different views from ordinary Americans, and don't we need people who see things from a broader and more global perspective, as well as the America firsters?
Certainly to some extent, but I think it does raise problems, or questions at least, in terms of what it means to be an American and what is the nature of our country, because historically, we always thought of citizenship, for instance, as being something exclusive. You could only have one citizenship, but now that idea is fading away.
There are any number of metaphors that have been used for how people live together in America: melting pot, tossed salad. You prefer the term tomato soup. Why soup and why tomato?
Well, I guess maybe because I like tomato soup. But, I mean, the point is, of course, that the basic ingredient of the soup is the Anglo-Protestant culture of the original settlers. But over the years, the tomato soup has been greatly enriched with spices and croutons and onions and all sorts of other things being added, which make it much more flavorful and interesting, but it still remains basically tomato soup.
Well, and what about Latino immigration in particular, which seems to concern you? Wouldn't Latinos simply be adding a little more spice to the soup?
Well, yes, quite possibly. But the question is whether the soup may become separated because the Hispanic immigration and presence is so different as a result of the huge numbers and the persistence and the concentration of Hispanic, principally Mexican immigrants in our southwest states. So we are in moving in the direction of becoming a bilingual, bicultural society.
Sounds more like gazpacho than tomato soup.
Yes, right.
Let me ask you finally, This book has sparked a fair amount of debate and criticism, just as your earlier book on the Clash of Civilizations did, which has since been borne out by events. Do you think time is on your side in this argument, too?
Well, I'm not making predictions in this book. I'm just trying to point what seemed to me to be trends. And I would hope that we would be able to develop ways of coping with the trends I have identified and dealing with them in a way which will preserve what I think has been a central factor in our greatness as a country and the factor that has attracted millions of immigrants to the society, which has basically been this culture which has emphasized liberty, individualism, the work ethic, opportunity, equality. I hope we can do that.
Thank you, Professor.
Okay, well, thank you very much.
Samuel Huntington is a Harvard professor and author of the new book, Who Are We? The Challenges to America's National Identity.
Tomorrow in Here and Now, we speak to the director of the Tennessee Williams play, Spring Storm. That's tomorrow.
Stay with us. There's more ahead. Here and Now.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Gail Harris.
It's Here and Now.
Israeli tanks and a helicopter gunship fired near or into a large crowd of demonstrators at the Rafah refugee camp. At least 10 children and teenagers have died, and dozens are reported wounded. The Israeli army says an investigation is underway. President Bush is calling for restraint on all sides. We spoke a short time ago to Reuters correspondent Cindy Johnson, who is in Rafah, to ask what happened.
Yeah, well, basically, we were out at Tel Sultan, which is an area of Rafah that is the Israeli troops are present there, and we heard several explosions. We rushed over there, and witnesses told us that Israeli tank had fired several shells into the demonstration, and some witnesses also said that Israeli helicopters had fired a missile into the demonstration. People described a scene where there were a bloody scene of people wounded on the street. Some people told me that they had seen faces completely covered in blood, an arm that was severed, a person who had his arm severed, and the doctors at the hospital in Rafah tell us that there are 10 people confirmed to have died, and they say most of the people who have been injured or killed are children.
Cindy, you're at that hospital now?
Yes.
It certainly sounds like it's a pretty confusing scene from what we're hearing in the background.
Yes, it's very crowded here. There are people milling outside the hospital, and there are also lots of medical personnel inside waiting to see if there will be any further casualties report. There are maybe dozens of people milling around, very upset, but quietly upset. They're not shouting or having a demonstration outside the hospital. And the hospital officials have actually had to close the gates of the hospital to keep out the crowds of people.
Are there enough medical personnel there to deal with this amount of injuries?
Well, the doctors say that they've actually had to try to transfer some of the patients to other hospitals in Khan Yunis if they can get through checkpoints, and other hospitals in Rafah to try to deal with it because they don't have enough operating theaters, they say that there were dozens of wounded from this strike on the demonstration.
What we're getting here from military sources is that a helicopter and a tank fired one round each after soldiers felt threatened. These were about 3,000 people out in the street. Did it seem to be a tense situation before this?
Well, to be honest, I wasn't at the demonstration before it happened, but from what we understand from witnesses who we spoke to, they were marching in a peaceful demonstration with the aim of opening the closure on this particular area. So they planned to walk through some of them said that they planned to walk through walk past the Israeli tanks in order to get into the area because they medical supplies and relief into the area, which has been under closure for maybe 48 hours. And they say that they weren't even carrying banners. They weren't even waving Palestinian flags, that they were just walking towards the opening to this area.
So apparently they were not anticipating trouble.
I couldn't say that for sure because I'm not there, but this is what witnesses tell us, and certainly we have from the doctor, in fact, the director of the hospital here, that most of the injured were, in fact, children.
Cindy, thank you.
Thank you.
Cindy Johnson is a correspondent for the Reuters news agency.
John Kerry will sit down with Ralph Nader this afternoon. No one seems to know exactly why, but the meeting at Kerry campaign headquarters in Washington comes just a week after Nader picked up the endorsement of the Reform Party, guaranteeing him a spot on the presidential ballot in at least 7 states, including the key swing states of Florida and Michigan. Ralph Nader spokesman Kevin Zeist joins us on the line. Welcome, Kevin.
How are you doing today?
I'm fine. Whose idea was this meeting?
It's been kind of an ongoing discussion with both. In fact, when we discuss it and try to ask ourselves that question, we can't remember who started the process.
Well, what's in it for Ralph Nader?
Well, Ralph has 2 goals in the campaign. First, he wants to make sure there's a populist, progressive message in the presidential discussion this year. And second, he wants to make sure that the Bush regime is removed from power in November.
Yeah, but why would he want to talk about that with his opposition?
Because there are areas where we see a two-front strategy could be effective.
In fact, you were quoted in the paper saying that one of the topics on the agenda for your team is to explain how your second front against George Bush is going to help remove Bush from power. Can you briefly explain that second front theory now?
Sure. Basically, Ralph Nader thinks that he can do 2 things to remove Bush. One, he can make Kerry a better candidate by encouraging Kerry to take better positions that energize his base. Secondly, we can go after Bush's base in ways that Kerry can't. For example, Ralph is calling for the impeachment of George Bush. Bush lied to get us in the war. He misled us to get us in the war. And secondly, the war was an illegal war. So we think that we can push those kinds of issues that Kerry can't. We can also go after Bush's base in ways that he can't. For example, you mentioned the Reform Party nomination. In the last election, a majority of Reform Party members voted for President Bush. Now they have Nader as their standard bearer.
Is there anything John Kerry could say to Ralph Nader today that would entice him to leave the race?
No, Ralph Nader believes that you don't drop into a race if you plan to drop out of a race. We have thousands of volunteers right now out on the streets collecting signatures to get Ralph on the ballot. It would be unfair to them to leave them high and dry and say we're going to drop out.
No. What if he was offered a cabinet position today or head of the EPA?
Ralph is in this race until the end. We're not seeking Democratic voters. We're seeking voters who are in Bush's base. And even polls are starting to show that. Just this last weekend, the CNN poll showed Nader was getting votes from Republicans and Democrats, Kerry supporters and Bush supporters equally. We've seen polls like that in the Wall Street Journal, the LA Times as well. The key is for the media to give us a fair shot and allow Nader's voice to be heard. If that happens, then we can have a wide open race.
Let's talk about some of Ralph Nader's positions. Oil prices, for instance, all-time high. Would Ralph Nader bring in a gas tax to reduce consumption?
Ralph Nader has done 2 things already on this. First, he has called for an investigation into why oil prices are so high. A lot of refineries have been closed down in recent years, and that's one of the major reasons why we have this kind of price rise. Secondly, he's called for us breaking our addiction to the fossil fuel economy and putting in place instead efficiency, renewable, clean energy sources. We have the technology to do that. We just need the will to make that kind of transition. Ralph has advocated a total change in our economy.
What would Ralph Nader talk to John Kerry about when it comes to Iraq?
Both Kerry and Bush are saying, stay the course. The key thing is to say we're going to get out, say when, and have an exit strategy.
And when is when?
Well, from Ralph Nader's perspective and a bunch of other former generals, intelligence officers, and military officials, 6 months is sufficient time.
6 months, it's a broken country. Would you leave a broken country?
We're not talking about leaving the country high and dry. We realize that George Bush has broken the country. Nader calls for a responsible withdrawal, which includes continued humanitarian aid to rebuild the country, an international peacekeeping force made up primarily of Arab, Muslim, and neutral countries, and finally it includes internationally supervised elections. That can occur in 6 months. Once you announce a withdrawal, the insurgency loses its steam, because what's pushing the steam right now is the recognition that we're putting in place a puppet government that's going to last for a long time.
Well, Kevin Zeese, I'm sure you're going to call us and tell us every single thing the two men talk about.
Every single thing.
Kevin Zeese, thank you.
All right. Thanks for having me on.
Kevin, spokesperson for Ralph Nader. He joined us from Washington, D.C.
Still to come, the Green Ogre returns to the big screen. We review Shrek 2.
And that other beast, Godzilla, celebrates his 50th anniversary.
You're listening to Here and Now.
Last night, in a win over the Atlanta Braves, pitcher Randy Johnson of the Arizona Diamondbacks became the oldest person to throw a perfect game. The 40-year-old Johnson shut out 27 hitters to accomplish that feat. And joining us online from Phoenix is KJZZ News Director Mark Moran. Mark, have you recovered?
Yeah, it's pretty amazing.
And I know you're a baseball fan, and perfect game, you know, sounds like a big deal. We know it is, but remind us, what does it mean?
Well, it's a huge deal. No runs, no hits, no walks. But as importantly, the defense behind the pitcher gives up no errors. So as the game wends on, you get the sixth, seventh, eighth inning, suddenly every defender in that field is thinking, oh, man, please don't let me be the one to make an error. Don't let me be the one to drop that fly ball that's hit right to me. And heaven forbid somebody should get a hit off him.
Right.
I don't know if any, you know, if you saw the reaction of the catcher, Robbie Hammock, who's a young kid who's just come up.
He was like a pop-up doll.
Well, he reminded me of Yogi Berra in 1956 when Don Larson threw the perfect game for the Yankees in the World Series. It was almost the same exact body language, just up and down and up and down, jumping just completely gleefully. It was funny to watch.
But meantime, Randy Johnson, reports are that as the game went on and it became obvious that he might get this, you know, historic perfect game, he looked like he was sleeping between innings.
Well, he's a very focused, intense person. Every interaction I've ever had with him, he's been very cordial, but he is one of the more intense athletes I've ever been around, and you don't even talk to him a day or even 2 days before he pitches. So you can only imagine his mind frame between innings when he realized that he's closing in on something he'd never accomplished before, and only 16 other pitchers in the history of Major League Baseball, and we're talking a long time, right, had ever done this. And he's the first 40-year-old to ever have done it. Cy Young was 37 when he did it, and that was 100 years ago. Right. So it's a milestone. It really caps his career. He was co-most valuable player of the World Series in 2001 when he helped knock off the Yankees in 7 games in dramatic fashion. He's had a no-hitter, but never a perfect game, and you can see it in his face. In the end, he actually cracked a little bit of a smile.
And remind us, he has had a no-hitter, not a perfect game. What's a no-hitter again?
A no-hitter is when they'll give up no hits, but he might have walked a person, or there might have been an error in the game. But
somebody
it's
got to base.
Game.
Yeah, somebody
no
got
runs,
to base.
No hits, no errors, no walks.
Right. Well, so you described how the other players were on the Diamondbacks. What about the Atlanta Braves and their fans?
Well, the fans were actually very cordial to Randy Johnson. Through towards about two-thirds of the way through the game, they were actually applauding him. And some of the quotes from the Braves players after the game, and we're talking high-profile people, Andrew Jones, Chipper Jones, two members of the Atlanta Braves, who said that Randy Johnson was just filthy. And what that means is that his pitches were as hard as they had ever seen to hit. He had Randy Johnson's famous for his fastball, but also his slider. There were some quotes from one of the Atlanta Braves players after last night's game, who'd played in 2,500 major league contests. That's a lot of games. And they said, have you ever seen a perfect game? And he said, no, I never have, and I hope to never see another one. We were embarrassed.
Yeah, because some people here, I should say not exactly baseball fans, were saying, well, as the game goes along, wouldn't the guys on the other team also be rooting for Randy Johnson? They're not, right?
No, absolutely not. I mean, there are stories about guys having perfect games and no-hit games broken up by bunts, which some people consider Bush League. But no, they're absolutely, they don't want to be no-hit.
Right.
They don't want to go down in the record books as being the team that had a perfect game thrown against them, even if it is by one of the most dominant pitchers in the game.
Well, but he did get a standing ovation from the thousands of fans in Atlanta when it was all over.
Yes, he did. I have to say, they were very cordial to him, and it was a truly amazing performance.
Yeah. Well, Mark Moran, thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Mark Moran, Arizona Diamondbacks fan and KJZZ News Director in Phoenix, Arizona.
Stay with me. I'm Gail Harris.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
Shrek is back. The lovable green ogre first made his appearance in 2001 in the hugely successful animated film of the same name. When we last saw our hero, voiced by Mike Myers, Shrek had rescued and won the heart of the princess, played by Cameron Diaz. She finds her inner ogress, marries the big lug, and they live happily ever after. Until now. Enter the in-laws, who also happen to be king and queen. Shrek 2 is a Guess Who's Coming to Dinner for the Lunchbox set. It opens today, and we're joined by Here and Now film reviewer Eric Schaefer. Eric, welcome.
Thank you, Robin.
And you know, no matter what you say, there are going to be little kids with their parents lined up at movie theaters. I can't wait.
That's right. Whatever I say won't make a bit of difference, but we'll go through the motions anyway.
Well, it sounds like the second film takes up where the first left off.
Basically, it does. We find our happily wedded ogre couple returning home after their honeymoon. They get this invitation to come to the land of far, far away and meet Fiona's mom and dad. But then we run into in-law trouble. The king and queen aren't expecting to find that their daughter has turned into an ogre, and they're not terribly happy about this.
So I suppose any grandchildren I could expect from you would be...
Ogres! Yes.
Not that there's anything wrong with that. Right, Harold?
Oh, no! No, of course not. That is, assuming you don't eat your own young...
Dad!
Oh, no, we usually prefer the ones who've been locked away in a tower.
Shrek, please.
I only did that because I love her.
Oh, hi! Daycare or Dragon Guarded Castle?
You wouldn't understand. You're not her father.
Now, let's remind people who hadn't seen the first one, the device, if you will, in Shrek 1, was that Fiona was a beautiful princess.
Right. She turns into an ogre at night, but when she finally finds true love at the end of the film, she also finds herself, and so she becomes an ogre, too,
right.
like Shrek.
And embraces her ogreness.
Right.
Which, it was a wonderful film for young girls,
yeah,
you know,
yeah.
to love yourselves no matter what you look like.
But this causes problems for her parents. They are not happy about this, particularly her father, who had intended her all along to marry Prince Charming. Mm-hmm. And so he decides that he is going to further that aim by hiring an assassin to kill Shrek. And that assassin just happens to be Puss in Boots.
Now, ye ogre, pray for mercy from Puss in Boots.
Ooh, I'll kill that cat.
And that's Antonio Banderas playing Puss in Boots, and he is by far the best thing in this movie. Just a hilarious character. There are several huge belly laughs that he delivers in this movie, and I'd say, you know, if there's any reason to see this movie, it's for Puss in Boots.
Well, what about the other stars? I mean, does Eddie Murphy's Donkey feel pushed aside by Puss in Boots?
Well, Donkey does sort of play second fiddle this time to Puss in Boots.
And Mike Myers, of course, is still Shrek.
He's still Shrek. Cameron Diaz is still Fiona. Both doing a fine job. We've also got other characters this time. Prince Charming is voiced by Rupert Everett, and the fairy godmother, who is also Prince Charming's mother, voiced by Jennifer Saunders. And they all do a fine job. I think where the movie falls apart a little bit is that it's not quite as unified as the first film was, which, of course, was based on a book. This film seems a little bit more slapdash, but there are a fair number of fun things in the movie.
The first movie as well seemed to have a storyline for parents. It was condemning big Hollywood. And wasn't there a stab at Disney and Michael Eisner?
Oh, yeah. And there are plenty of little, you know, swipes at Disney this time around as well. When they first arrive, when Shrek and Fiona first arrive in Far, Far Away, it's essentially like they're coming into L.A. There's Rodeo Drive and there are all the Starbucks and everything, the Paramount Gate. And the big final scene, which takes place at a large ball, is essentially like major Hollywood awards show, even with Joan Rivers stalking the red carpet. So there's plenty of stuff for parents to enjoy in this movie as well.
Do you think that this film is going to do as well? I mean, the first Shrek pulled in over $250 million.
I'm sure it's going to be huge. It's a fun film. You know, there's no way getting around that. It may not be quite up to the level of the first one, but I think that families are still going to enjoy themselves.
Bye-bye, Troy.
Poor Brad Pitt. Poor he didn't Brad even Pitt. Have a chance against the big green ogre, did he?
No. Thank you, Eric.
You're welcome, Robin.
Here in Now Film Reviewer, Eric Schaefer on Shrek 2.
There's another monster making his way back into theaters in the next few months, Godzilla. The 150-foot prehistoric creature returns 50 years after he first stormed into Tokyo theaters. American audiences will not be seeing the version they may be familiar with. Rather, it's the uncut Japanese original. Joining us on the line is longtime Godzilla fan, Steve Reifel. Steve, welcome.
Thank you.
Can you briefly give us some of the differences between the film that Americans saw back in the 50s, titled Godzilla, King of the Monsters, and what they'll see as a re-release?
Well, first of all, Raymond Burr is not anywhere to be found. The version that we all grew up with is a highly edited and recut version that was retailed for American audiences, and more than 30 minutes of the original Japanese version were deleted. Content-wise, the main difference that you'll notice is it's a very, very bleak, somber film, and there are a number of direct references to the atomic testing at the Pacific Proving Grounds. There's a lot of references to nuclear weapons and radiation that really were kind of washed over in the American version.
Well, and as you say, I think for years people have viewed Godzilla as shorthand for a cheesy monster movie, but it now seems to be viewed as one of the great anti-nuclear films.
I would say so. I mean, it's right up there with Dr. Strangelove in its own way. If people are willing to go into the theaters with an open mind, this could prove to be something of a revelation.
There are something like 26 sequels. Do you have a favorite?
My favorite film of all, other than the original, would be Godzilla vs. Mothra, which was titled Godzilla vs. the Thing. And that just features this epic battle between Godzilla and first the adult Mothra, and then after that's killed, the twin caterpillars hatch from the egg and confront Godzilla in this titanic struggle.
Yeah, there's a story for you. And I understand that Toho Studios, which owns the Godzilla franchise, is promising a 28th film in December. Might that be the last?
That's what they're saying, and of course I tend to believe that it's a great publicity stunt, but it's going to be a slam-bang ending, at least for now, to the series. There's something like 10 monsters in the movie.
After all these years, why do you think Godzilla still holds so much appeal?
Well, I think it really all goes back to something very basic, and that is that boys love dinosaurs, because Godzilla is the greatest dinosaur that you've ever seen. And by the way, I meet very, very few Godzilla fans who are female. And these creatures and the world that they exist in are just so fantastical. And if you're a person, you know, whose imagination is piqued by that sort of thing, it's just irresistible.
But it's a guy thing.
Well, not in the way that fixing cars is, but yeah, it tends to be something that attracts boys more than girls.
Steve, thank you.
Well, thank you for having me.
Steve Reifel is the author of Japan's Favorite Monstar, the unauthorized biography of Godzilla. And to find out when and where Godzilla will be playing, you can go to our website, here-now.org.
We'll be right back.
is a production of WBUR Boston.
I'm Gail Harris.
I'm Robin Young.
Get into your radio.
And join us again, here and now. For a cassette or CD of Here and Now, go to our website, here-now.org, or call 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes or CDs are $15 each, which includes shipping and handling.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.